And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
The Earth, our home, is a great mystery. Cultures around the world have wondrous stories of how it all came to be. Indigenous people see the animals, plants, and humans as interconnected. So why has the Earth, what many believe to be the work of God's hand, taken such a beating and yet remained a minimal part of the mainstream faith communities? We explore this mystery and what is happening in churches, synagogues, and mosques across America as they reunite with the creation. When we return here on the Wildside News. So where do you come in on this emerging story of the future of life on Earth? Do you think about it? Do you care? Does it matter? Well, on the Wildside News, we bring you each week the latest updates on what scientists and researchers are discovering about global warming, the oceans, our forests, land, and cohabitors of planet Earth. And the story keeps getting more dramatic. Serious discussions are taking place about the potentials for radical shifts in animal populations, some referring to them even as mass extinctions. If such is true, we have dropped the ball big time. Our paradise of wonder, this Garden of Eden, to which we were given dominion, according to some ancient faiths, is under siege. For many of us who have been championing the cause to save this earthly mystery, we have been perplexed by the near total lack of concern or involvement by those who are tied to the divine plan by covenant, whether they be Christian, Jew, or Muslim, or others. And to many, the continuing silence is what is most astonishing, as the research and rumors raise the prospect of dramatic earthly upheaval. But things are changing in the God-Earth community. Congregations of all faiths are coming together to address the spiritual nature of nature and the requirement to love and care for God's creation. Today, we spend the hour talking about what is emerging in the creation care movement. We begin the show with a visit to one of the nation's premier cathedrals, the Grace Cathedral in San Francisco, and talk with the Episcopal Reverend Sally Bingham and the Regeneration Project. We continue our discussion as we delve deeper into the interpretation of the spiritual nature of Earth and God's purpose in putting it all together during our second segment. Then, in segment three, we head on over to Michigan and talk with Mark Cleavy and the Energy Star program that is saving money, saving energy, saving the planet, and in the long term, saving souls. It's a divine union of sorts that brings a positive realignment back into the churches. So, following a brief look at the news, we focus on emerging work of Churches United for the Earth. But first, the news. President Bush is finding many within his faith-based coalition coalescing in a new campaign, a campaign to save the environment. More than 1,000 Catholic, Protestant, and Jewish leaders are spreading a petition pressing Bush to change his environmental policies. The environment is a values issue, said Reverend Ted Haggard, president of the 30-million-member National Association of Evangelicals. In a strange twist, the group is organizing to protect unborn fetuses, which can suffer harm from mercury pollution, regulations which the president's Clear Skies initiative relaxed. And many evangelicals, who shy away from the term environmentalist, are wearing the robe of creation care, which states the mission from a God-centered perspective. The effort is being joined by none other than James Dobson of Focus on the Family, who is parting ways with the administration over the environment. Many find it interesting that this alliance is leading the way, as memories of a total lack of the term environment being even mentioned during the debates by either candidate rattle in the halls of history. We visit this topic during our show today. A Portland, Oregon judge has ruled that the Bush administration's relaxed protections for the western gray wolf violated the Endangered Species Act. In a unique form of gerrymandering, the U.S. wolf population was divided east and west, as the wolves in a few areas would make up for the absence of wolves in much larger regions. The classification of wolf status was sort of generalized by Interior Secretary Gail Norton, according to Michael Robinson of the Center for Biological Diversity. We will keep you informed of this ruling and its effects on the U.S. wolf population in the months ahead. The House is about to rule on a bill to reopen ANWR for oil and gas exploration against the strong opposition by various conservation organizations in order to reduce reliance on Middle East oil, according to President Bush. Moderate Republicans and Democrats in the Senate oppose the move, as they believe the refuge does not hold enough crude to justify the destruction of habitat critical to polar bears, caribou, and other wildlife. OPEC, meanwhile, decided to hold production at current levels, which is fueling a new standard in a barrel of oil at $50. OPEC believes this new price will not have deleterious effects on the global economy. The good old days are gone. Gone are the days when citizens could unite in class action suits and challenge various threats by taking the accused violators to state court. No longer. The Class Action Fairness Act now moves essentially all class action suits to the federal level, thereby necessitating much greater legal fees to litigate and dramatically extending the time required to try the cases. Amendments by Senators Kennedy and Bingaman will attempt to mitigate these requirements, thus bringing such actions back to the people in their own states. Remember Antarctica, the vast frozen continent? Well, scientists recently noted that the effects of global warming could make one half of the continent unstable and potentially cause it to break off from its underwater rock support and plunge into the ocean. It may take a while, but leading scientists predict that if such were to happen, the sea would rise by 16 feet. Whereas this had been predicted to happen sometime in the next 100 to 1,000 years, the time frame has shrunk. If such happened, it would have catastrophic effects around the world, as whole nations and regions would be submerged. Noah, Noah, where art thou? One of our most wonderful earthly companions, the orangutans, those slow-moving, ET-inspiring friends of the Earth, may disappear within 10 to 20 years. Sounds like a long way off? No. That's a couple and a half presidential terms away. These natural tree huggers live 99% of their lives in trees. So, as their native forests continue to be broken and penetrated by legal and illegal logging, their future is compromised. And to add to the dilemma, their natural habits make the challenge of their survival even greater. Females are not inclined to want to move from their homes. Therefore, as food supplies diminish, so too their health and strength. And unlike other mammalian species, orangutan females only bear children once every 8 years. That means they are facing little more than one generation of existence. Sounds challenging. It is. We must awaken to the need to act now, globally, to address our future on this planet. And that's the news. We are joined now by Reverend Sally Bingham at the legendary Grace Cathedral in San Francisco. Sally, let's begin with you telling us about the wondrous Grace Cathedral.
Oh, Grace Cathedral is a beautiful Gothic cathedral. It's, I think, the third largest in this country, and it sits on the top of Nob Hill. It has beautiful stained glass windows and some Italian doors that were created by Ghiberti. It's quite a lovely place. It's quite large.
And how long ago was it actually constructed?
They started building it in the early 1900s, got to about halfway through in the 30s, and then ran out of money and did not start construction again until 1960, and then completed the cathedral with the stairs and the cathedral house and diocesan house and the school, all completed by 1964.
Well, it's a seriously large place, and that may have something to do with the emergence of your effort to become more energy conscious and the beginning of your work.
True. The cathedral didn't actually start me thinking about the work I do, but I certainly have tried to implement some of what I believe at the cathedral, in some cases more successful than others. Because the cathedral is so large, we pay in the area of $10,000 a month for heating. That's for the whole close, not just the cathedral, but it's still an enormous amount of money that we spend on electricity. And I have talked to the trustees, and we're entertaining the idea of putting solar on our roof, which would be really a wonderful thing, and it would be a nice icon for the city, too.
Very interesting. Well, I think part of this effort to really address the energy conservation aspect, and we're going to talk about the spiritual aspects of the environment in our second segment, but this concept of your efforts to create the Regeneration Project and something that has become known now as the IPL, which is spreading across the country, began back in the 1990s with the energy crisis in California.
Mm-hmm. And largely because people's electrical bills were so enormous, we could start with conservation right away, and that's one of the things we've done at the cathedral, where we haven't succeeded in having solar put on the roof yet. We have put in sensors in the bathroom so that there are no lights going when no one's in there. Often children will run into a room and then leave lights on, and they'll stay on for a week before somebody comes back in. In small parishes around the countryside, that happens. But we have recommended that churches put sensors in their bathrooms and that they use compact fluorescent light bulbs all over the facility. And there even are the kind that work the way a spotlight does for a big sanctuary. We have LED exit lights, which use considerably less electricity, and that's a money-saving technology, and it at the same time saves churches from putting a lot of carbon dioxide into the air because they're cutting down on their usage. But the hook for congregations in the very beginning of this work in the early 1990s was actually saving money for the parish. And then we asked them to get energy-efficient appliances because, as you probably know, the old refrigerators that hang around parishes that have been there for 30 and 40 years are very inefficient energy users. And if you can replace a refrigerator, you can save your congregation a lot of money as well.
Well, this started out sort of focused around the Grace Cathedral, but it has been growing. Well, let's talk about what is emerging.
Well, we started a program called Episcopal Power and Light, and the notion was that we'd ask all Episcopal churches across this country to buy renewable energy because we can't do it in California now, but there still are plenty of states around the country where you can buy energy directly from a clean, renewable source. That would be sun, wind, biomass, geothermal, and hydro. Those are things that do not create greenhouse gases. When a congregation can buy their electricity from one of these green marketers and they talk about it in the church, then people will go back into their homes and do the same thing. So we started this in 1997, Episcopal Power and Light. Well, within about 3 years, we had Presbyterians, Lutherans, Methodists, all kinds of different denominations who were interested in joining us, and I would get phone calls saying, is this just for Episcopal churches? Sort of simultaneously with the curiosity from other denominations, California went through the energy crisis. So I went up and allied with the California Council of Churches, and because during that energy crisis, the green marketers left California, all of our churches that had switched over to a green company were switched back to our regular utility, and the green marketers went off to other states. But what we did is decided we would get involved in the politics of this energy move, and that we would also continue on a energy conservation movement, if you will, mm-hmm. for congregations, asking them to cut their energy use, and then we got politically involved and helped pass this clean car bill that happened out here in California just last year. As we became more well known for working with congregations and people in the pews, we were funded by a national foundation to get a national campaign manager who we hired, and now we are working in 15 states and in Washington, D.C. We have a Massachusetts Interfaith Power and Light, Maine, Illinois, Georgia, New Jersey, Oregon, New Mexico, and on and on. And they are cropping up around the country with an affiliation to us, and they agree to work with our principles. And all of that information, how to become an Interfaith Power and Light program in your state, is all on our website, which is www.theregenerationproject.org. That's the actual ministry nonprofit that I'm the executive director of.
And how did you choose the Regeneration Project as a name?
Regeneration is a spiritual renewal. And we thought that when you talk about generation for energy, I mean, where does it come from? You're talking about generators. And then it tied into spiritual renewal and regeneration of the soul. And it just seemed like there was no other word but the Regeneration Project.
It's a great term and a great concept, and ultimately, hopefully, a great transformative force.
Well, that's what we're hoping. We're very hopeful that if we can have, maybe Interfaith Power and Light programs in 25 states over the next 5 years, that it'll be a real movement, that we can say the religious community not only is making a difference, but is starting a kind of third wave, another movement like the civil rights movement. We think that any really successful cultural change in this country has been led by the religious community, and the hope is here that we are now in a leadership position to lead again, to get the U.S. off its dependency on fossil fuel for energy.
Now, in terms of real effect, the churches that are participating, is there any estimate in terms of the energy that is being saved across the country as a result of your work?
Mm-hmm. We have here in California, where we have 300 congregations, it's over 300, it's probably 315 congregations that have joined, and that represents about roughly 120,000 people. We calculated last year when we did our annual report that we had prevented 19,000 tons of CO2 from entering the atmosphere.
That's astonishing.
And my guess is that the other programs, we're right now creating a way that our members can go into the website, mm-hmm. and say, we put in 35 compact fluorescent light bulbs, we got a new refrigerator, and we have solar on our roof. And this program will calculate how much CO2 has been prevented from going into the atmosphere. And the Environmental Protection Agency is working on that with us.
It's interesting that the government, how is it? Because a lot of people would suggest that the government and churches are supposed to have a hands-off policy. Something is different here.
Well, it is different because the Environmental Protection Agency has something that they call Energy Star. You may have even seen some of the advertisements for Energy Star appliances.
Certainly, everyone does, yeah.
Okay. They have Energy Star congregations, and you can find it on the EPA website. And when one of our congregations joins a program, they become a member of the Energy Star program as well, and they have a hotline. There's an 800 number where the congregation folks can call in and get information over the telephone from the EPA.
That's so interesting. So across the nation, I mean, the statistics that you gave really were for California, but when you start adding 25 states, we're talking about a serious impact, and yet, in reality, it's just a beginning, isn't it?
It is just a beginning, and you know, Sydney, there are 340,000 houses of worship in this country.
Wow.
And our program is probably reaching not more than about 2,000 right now, but we're new. I mean, this is a new idea for a lot of congregations. When I go in and talk to people about environmental stewardship, they don't grasp and embrace this message until they've heard it a couple of times, but once they get it, then, you know, we're really on our way to doing something great. And I feel that this snowball that's turning is getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Why do you think it's taken the churches this long to really see the importance of this type of work to serve the earth, which, after all, from many different perspectives, religious perspectives, is the work of God's hand?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a good question. I think for a number of years, the religious community felt that anything that had to do with the environment could be taken care of by the environmental community. And it's only recently that the religious leaders have come to realize that human behavior is destroying what God created for us to have, not just now, but for all the generations that come after us. And now that religious leaders are realizing that the stewardship of creation is very much a part of who they are as people of faith, if you say you love God, you have a responsibility to take care of God's creation. And I believe up until quite recently, they just thought the environmental community would take care of it. And believe me, clergy people are very busy. And when they go to seminary, they don't learn environmental ethics, and they don't take classes in ecology. They go to seminary and they learn liturgy, and they learn how to pray with people, and they learn how to do pastoral care at the bedside, and visiting people in prisons and hospitals, and how to, if you have a congregation of 400 people that you look after, you have to deal with sorrows and joys and weddings and baptisms. And I think that probably they wish that the environmental community was taking care of all the environmental problems. I don't think they've ever been disinterested. I think that it just hasn't been a priority. But I believe that in the last 3 to 5 years, it has become a priority. You might notice that there's a lot going on in the press these days with religious leaders saying this and that, writing letters to George Bush and saying that we want to do something about global warming.
It's an interesting matrix in the sense that even many within the environmental community itself have kind of a hands-off relationship with the church for various reasons. And yet the success of their movement is so dependent upon getting the message out and really involving a vast cross-section of American population. And quite honestly, I don't think there is any more effective network, if you just bring it right down to that, than actually the churches, and you're bringing that network together so effectively in this effort.
Well, this is what's been so extraordinary, but it also, there's a very fine line now and a kind of thread we can't break between remaining completely theological and coming at this with a foundation in religion versus coming at it from an environmental perspective. Because as you probably know, there are a lot of objections in certain communities to environmentalists. And we don't want to be seen as environmentalists because we're not. I mean, we're not tree huggers in the sense that we love trees more than people. Our care and concern for creation is because we are part of creation, not separate from it, but actually part of it. We have a place in this web of life. And if the balance is being disturbed, it's up to people of faith to help it stay in balance. Not because we like to put on our backpacks and our hiking shoes and go out climbing in Yosemite, as much as we've been called to be stewards of creation, stewards of each other, to serve one another, to love our neighbors as ourselves. And those are theological, moral reasons for taking care of creation. So when we're invited, which happens often now, environmental groups come to the religious communities looking for language that will reach out to perhaps the evangelical crowd or just to get the message that environmental groups care, are stewards too, and they like to use some of the religious language. We like to share our language, but we have to be very careful not to be usurped and be called the Sierra Club at prayer, because you can see where if I wear an environmental hat and go into a congregation that's skeptical anyway, I'm not going to be very well received. But if I go in as a priest with my foundation in theology and I talk about service to one another and service to God, they get the message.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sally, I want you to hold on, because when we come back, we're going to search the scriptures of sorts for the secrets of God's gift of life and the special role we humans have in this divine plan. We're going to take a look at the spiritual nature of nature when we return here on the Wild Side News, as we bring you the voice of the earth around the world.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
There are lots of ways to connect with nature. We take walks, we ride bikes, we read and head to the wilderness, and in most cases, we find a special clearing that comes with our connections with the wild places. To many, it is a communion. A communion with what? Some mysterious truth? Some powerful force? Yes, to many, it is a way to sense the divine. When we return, we continue our quest into the mysteries of the spiritual nature of nature here on the Wildside News, your 24/7 listening post to the voice of the earth.